Hey guys, Dre Harrison here from the post-production bench at an office somewhere in central London. Just letting you know that unfortunately, due to internet connection problems, Cam Buckley dropped out of this podcast about halfway through. So if in case you're wondering why you don't get to hear Cam a lot in the second half of this recording, that's the reason why. Sorry about that, not much we can do on our end about that one. But anyway, hope you enjoy the rest of the show. Bad news, as host of Motorsport 101, I have to put my prediction belt back on the wall. This will now be a 1 hour morning session. Welcome back to Motorsport 101. Let the record show, it's all Pierre Guidi's fault. Hi everybody, welcome to episode 592 of Motorsport 101. I'm your friendly neighbourhood host, Trey Harrison. Glad you could join us. As ever, for another edition. Well, again, this is part two of our little triple threat of podcasts for the week. We've also got IndyCar on Gateway lined up because that was probably the best IndyCar race of the year so far. Probably in the conversation, I'd say so.
Not if you're Joseph Newgarden.
God, more on that later. A rough time indeed. But this is the big one. This is the one you've all been waiting for, the one you've all been asking for. It's the review of our 24 hours of Le Mans. And I'm going to get right into it by introducing us around the panel. First up, he's the happiest a Porsche fan has ever been to finish a Le Mans in second. It's Cameron Buckley. Hello, Cam. How's it going?
You know, personally, I'm just here so I don't get fined. which, given the state of the BOP this year, has driven those within the sport to go, you know, actually, it's worth getting fined. Fuck this. from the Toyota and Peugeot contingent. Hey, I'll take driving crew of the day.
If you had 75 seconds for the over-under on the first mention of the term BOP, congratulations, you win the pool.
I'm not going to say F-bomb.
Wait a minute, Ray, you said this was a triple threat, but I hear a voice that suggests this is now a fatal four-way match.
I've just been handed a briefcase by one former tennis player, an occasional writer for Jalopnik. His schedule got freed up, so he decided to join us for tonight's recordings. Welcome back, Mr. Ryan Eric King, everybody. Good to see you, King. How's it going?
I'm glad to be here. It was certainly a Le Mans. If you ask anyone that is not Ferrari.
Now, hold on a second. King, are you just here just to talk lyrical about Robert Kubica rape? Are you just here to talk lyrically about Roger Federer waving the tricolor and hanging out with all the drivers and the big wigs before the race?
No, but it is certainly an opportune coincidence.
Absolutely. You know, I hear that Novak Djokovic was considered for the role of the starter of the 24 Hours Le Mans, but in reality, it turns out he didn't have a shot.
10 points deducted from RJ O'Connell.
It's the gif of the monkey on the drum set.
Nope,
disapprovingly.
Nope. I'm getting a first news report that is actually going to be an extra 20 kilograms to Toyota Gazoo Racing.
Oh, I thought it was going to be an extra 20 kilograms to me, and I already feel like I'm getting heavier than I should be.
Look, you were too busy enjoying French cuisine, RJ O'Connell, because you've just finally headed back to the States. And you're on the road again to Watkins Glen this weekend. Clearly, that brother's struggling up there, clearly. also I love that he's been legally obligated to wear his dailysportscar.com t-shirt knowing that he's going to be on a Motorsport 101 podcast talking about sports cars. I guess it's a fair shake, isn't that right, RJ?
Gentlemen, it's a fair shake. If I can't be back on the week of sports cars, this will just have to do chatting sports cars with my friends.
It's as good a reason as any. It's only fair that we steer to you because you were actually there in person again. We'll say third time now at Le Mans.
So yeah,
one more, you get a free half chicken from Nando's. Congratulations.
I have been blessed that my first year was the centenary and the launch of the golden, platinum, diamond, plutonium age of sports cars. I could not imagine if my first year was the 5 years of the preceding dark age that that came before it, or if I had come in like the mid-2010s of the height of LMP1H and then had to deal with that for 5 years. But overall, I had another good time. This year was definitely an improvement because I didn't get sick all week.
That's a plus.
I may or may not have been dealing with a kidney stone flare-up for basically the entire Saturday. Don't get those, kids.
No.
Do not get them. They are awful. That's why I'm still drinking water, because, man, I feel okay right now.
You're in a better spot than Robert Kubica was for a lot of the last 3.5 hours of the breaks by having water. I don't take these opportunities to go to Le Mans for granted to be able to talk with the people that cover the sport for other outlets, English media, media from other languages, etc. I don't take the opportunity for granted to ride along the public roads that make up part of the track. I don't take the opportunity for granted to intermingle with the over 300,000 fans that are there every year. It's crazy that Le Mans is an event that the tickets go on sale 9 months out, and if you're not lined up to get a ticket the day they go on sale, you're screwed. You're not going to the 24 hours of Le Mans unless you work for the team or you're a VIP or know somebody, etc. It's just an amazing atmosphere. Like, I've been to Daytona and Sebring a couple times. Daytona's a nice race. Sebring, out of the two of them, I would say has the better atmosphere. But there's nothing like Le Mans. If you've not been, you owe it to yourself to at least make an earnest attempt to try and get out. By hook or by crook, get out and go to a 24-hour Le Mans. It's what Danny Brennan did. It's what he's been doing the last couple years. I'm envious of that man.
Very envious of that man that he's able to do that. He's all in. He's got the French partner and all. He's down there living the dream over on that side of the channel. And RJ mentioned about the atmosphere and the people around. We talked about it just before we went on the air. 332,000 over the weekend at an all-time Le Mans attendance record as far as records began.
Trust me, it sure feels like it. When you look out in the grandstands at the start and the finish of the race, it definitely feels like all 300,000 of them are packing that front grandstands. And I know that's not the case because Le Mans is such a big track.
Oh, yeah. It covers the surface area of roughly a small moon. You can very easily get 300,000 plus camping. But it's basically motorsports Glastonbury. Only the music's not quite as good. That is incredible numbers to pull over the course of best part of a week, really, given the whole, if you're there for the full Le Mans experience, if you're there for practice, depends when you roll up, if it's for practice and all the qualifiers
are just spread out. If you're one of the diehards that pulls up for scrutineering the weekend before the race, you're not even seeing cars running. You're just seeing them go through like a pretty casual tech inspection and then listening to the drivers talk and answer basic questions on stage like, how do you think you're going to do at Le Mans? I think I'm going to do great. Thank you for everybody coming out to the center of town to watch our cars get pushed through the streets.
Yeah, how many drills are in this rear wing? Just won't come up later. It's fine.
Giving the plot away.
Remember that. It becomes important later, but not that important.
But you know what becomes important later is, we got more manufacturers coming. We knew we had more manufacturers coming, but we got to learn a little bit more. Who's running Ford? Who's supplying chassis to Ford? Who's helping to run Genesis? What the McLaren Hypercar looks like and what the McLaren Hypercar team name is.
All of that. Yeah, that was a lot of prologuing and pre-gaming for this Le Mans. There was a lot. Obviously, McLaren unveiled their Hypercar. It looks like a hypercar. That's my professional opinion.
It definitely looks striking.
It kind of looks like if you fed a GTP/hypercar into an AI machine, because it's got bits and pieces of a bunch of them.
It does, doesn't it?
Also, like, if you've seen a modern McLaren, it kind of looks like a GTA generic supercar.
Yeah.
So it just ends up looking like you fed it into ChatGPT and it spat out an image.
It looks a bit like it looks like a slightly bigger setup. That's what it feels like. It looks a little bit like that. So RJ, run us down the best of the pre-game in here in terms of Ford and Genesis and whatnot. What leapt off the page to you?
I think for Ford, their chassis supplier being Orica, not a huge surprise for those who've been following the story, is that Orca's going to supply them the chassis. They also got Dan Sayers of Red Bull Powertrains to manage the hypercar team when it launches in 2027, which, gotta say, pretty savvy move. Everything I've heard is that Dan Sayers is very, very well liked within the paddock. So that's fun.
They also hear that James Barkley is moving over from Jaguar's Formula E team to help run it as well. And I was like,
oh, yes.
I was like, that's why James Barkley stepped away from Jaguar after all these years.
Yeah, of course.
This is the best Ford. It is the best Ford Jaguar collaboration since the 1991 World Sports Car. Certainly wasn't the F1 team.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, McLaren got James Barkley to help run the team alongside Zach Brown, Richard Dean. You know, pretty outstanding brain trust there. As for who's driving these cars from Ford and Genesis and McLaren, well, we don't know yet. I'm sure there are going to be tons of internal candidates from their GT programs. In Genesis cases, they have an LMP2 project that they are likely to promote from within, and they've already got two drivers signed, and Andre Blatter and Pipo Durrani. It's just a matter of who's filling out. As for McLaren, well, they got many branches to pick from. If you're an ex-McLaren F3 driver, you're probably invited. If you're a McLaren single-seater prospect or young driver, you're probably invited. If you're one of the three McLaren GT factory drivers, you're probably invited.
What if you're Alex Palou?
You are not invited. Get the fuck out of my office.
And as for Genesis, very random that they got Gabriele Tarquini to help run the team. Bringing in Justin Taylor, the former Ferrari race engineer who won Le Mans 2023, I think that's a good move. I like the moves that they're making. It's going to be fascinating to see how they turn up. And if you didn't see the presentation of the first sketch of the car, feels like Genesis is designing a car that is meant to win no matter the circumstances. They're not making a car that is designed to take advantage of advantageous BNP, run with it. They want to be an all-rounder. It's a good strategy, and we're in a good place because, most importantly, out of all this, we got confirmation that the unified top class prototype regulations have been extended another few years to 2032, which means we got a few more years of this.
Seven more years of this. I mean, when was the last time in motorsport the rule set is going to have a decade under its belt?
Other than the IndyCar series?
Complimentary in brackets, I should say.
The fourth generation of the NASCAR Cup Series.
Yeah,
I guess. I don't know how those cars
and changes.
How those cars ended is not how those cars started at fucking all.
Yeah, it was a bit of a divergence from what we started with in '92 to what we ended in within parts of 07.
Yeah. Really, 03 is when things went off the rail with those cars. I mean, I'm trying to think right now, even in sports car terms, like original Group C didn't last that long because original Group C went from 82 until the end of 90. That is unprecedented longevity, even in this form of racing. And I think that's a good thing because that's going to hopefully keep costs down. It's going to help cars propagate across multiple series, not only IMSA and WEC, but we also got the news that in the future, privateer entries will be allowed into the Asian Le Mans series.
Oh, King, can you imagine Pro-Am teams, mandatory bronzes, boutique hypercar manufacturers?
I thought Click was dead.
Oh, it ain't Click we gotta worry about. It's Madwall.
King's just had a dramatic flashback and he's just seen a closed fist come out of the ground and the cemetery. And it's painted with a cowboy hat on top of it.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a cowboy hat on top of the grave.
There's another hand reaching out and it's got one of those tooth scrapers because Colin Coles used to work as a dentist.
It all makes sense now with the way Madwall was run.
So let me get this straight as the non-massive sports car guy. Like, yes. Madwall and I think it's like Zotta Franchitti have both confirmed they're going to be back in
this
series.
They want to be back because they see Asian Le Mans Series new hypercar class, which will launch in the winter of 26 into 27, as their opportunity to get on the grid. Because the reality is, right now, there's no place on the World Endurance Championship grid for them as it stands.
Yeah, because so if you are at exactly? WEC, you got to run two factory cars.
Yes. And they haven't got the resources to run two, right?
Yeah. Yes.
They barely have. They didn't even really have the resources to run one, despite the fact that the Asada Frasche was actually a reasonably decent car.
Yeah. It wasn't terrible.
Well enough in its year, but hey, drivers derogatory kind of defined that program.
There's the thing, though. Now that you're in a pro-am class where you have to carry bronze driver, the money's going to take care of itself, and you can probably bring in two other guys who are actually quick to help finance the team and hopefully get in the car. I'm excited for the prospect of these privateers in the Asia-Pacific market having a bidding war to see which bronzes want to drive a hypercar that badly. I'm also curious to see how that's going to interface with World Endurance Championship having a no bronze is allowed rule in hypercar right now.
Okay.
Like, it feels like we're slowly moving to a place where, at Le Mans only, at least, there'll be a pro-am hypercar class.
Probably.
I don't know how I feel about that.
It's not unprecedented. I'm sure there are some people who say that it's 24 hours of Le Mans should have no amateur element, but I don't think
that hasn't been the case for nearly two decades now.
Ever.
We've always had main characters at Le Mans derogatory, but in terms of pro-am categories, in terms of it being ratified in the rules, we've had pro-ams at Le Mans for a long time now.
Yeah.
Oh, but these cars are so fast.
Yeah.
They're the only cars that Ben Keating was intimidated by, and that man drives everything.
Yeah, and I need to remind, and this is a small spoiler as we move into the main story of Le Mans, the top speed clocked during this year's race was 364 kilometers an hour.
No, it was not. That was a sensor issue. We found out later. It was still the Ferraris, you'll be shocked having watched this race, at about 349 kilometers per hour.
Oh no, they were only going 218 rather than 227. Goddamn.
Back at the start of the 70s, those things were clocking 245 down the Mulsanne.
But we didn't have the two chicanes in the middle to break it up.
Yeah.
And not only are these cars fast, they're complex. Most of them have hybrid systems.
Yeah. Most of them have hybrids. They are notoriously difficult buttons, memorization systems, like Formula One level, essentially, when it comes to how complicated they are. And I've seen people working those steering wheels and all those settings. It is like trying to drive a 220 mile an hour computer. And if that sounds terrifying to you, it probably is.
And this even applies to the so-called like budget rate LMDH cars, which I can't believe we're still even having that argument of like philosophically, what's the superior format when the whole point of convergence is that these two platforms are meant to interface together for the large part that they have.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Especially when these LMDH cars have the lateral brake migration that people went up in arms and berserk that they thought Red Bull had in F1 last year. They didn't. These cars have that because the engines might be limited in scope. The hybrid systems might be, again, limited compared to the run whatever you want in a nature of LMP1H as it was a decade ago. Yeah. The software is fair game. The software is practically the battleground at this point.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Just like formerly, except here, it seems like manufacturers want to show up here for a change.
Yeah, indeed. Shall we get into the main event here, folks?
Yes, but first, Trey, tell the people listening out there where we can find more like this.
Yes, you can find us on youtube.com/motorsport101. You can find us on Twitter at motorsport_101 if you have to follow us personally on Blue Sky. And I think all of us pretty much just got the same usernames on Blue Sky and Twitter at this point. Dre Harrison 101 on Twitter. Just get rid of the 101 if you're on Blue Sky. Ryan Eric King, RJ O'Connell, and C Buckley 917. Otherwise, you can follow us on Instagram at motorsport101pod. And on TikTok at M101_podcast. You can get some highlights on there as well. If you like your podcast in the more visual medium, you can do that if you so choose. If you like your content to be written. We've expanded, King. You didn't see the outhouse outside?
It's a cottage, I'll have you know it sleeps four with two bunk beds and enough space to barely fit everybody's suitcases and backpacks in.
Bitchin'. It's a good outhouse, I promise you. You can also check out the website, motorsport101.com. We've written content there as well with your boy having written an Austray. You got the reviews of Formula One's Canadian Mess and IndyCar at Gateway as well. So you can check all that out if you haven't already. And of course, if you really like us, you can back us financially on Patreon, patreon.com/motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to all of our content. You get upgraded to the $10 tier, so you can listen to these episodes live as they're being recorded, as Ghost Raptor's doing, as Kira is doing, as Rory is doing. A bunch of yous in here tonight listening along. Emma's in here as well. Thanks everybody for tuning in. I'm glad you were just as excited as we were. Also, if you're the sort of person who likes to pay for these things in bulk, there's a 30% discount in it for you if you want to back us for a whole year in advance. How nice of us. It's basically 12 months for the price of 9, essentially. So you can do that if you're that way inclined as well. Thanks as ever for all the ongoing support. Right after this, let's review the 93rd running of the 24 Hours of Le Mans.
350,000 fans are waiting. Millions worldwide are waiting. For the third year in a row, the Prancing Horse will top the podium at Le Mans. 51 broke a long drought in 2023. 51 last year, and the 83 AF Corsa Ferrari wins Le Mans 2025. What a story and what a final 2 hours plus from Robert Kubica. 15 seconds at the line ahead of Kevin Est's Porsche.
Well, the hat trick is complete. A Ferrari 499P has won the 24 Hours of Le Mans for the third year in a row, but this time it wasn't the two red factory Ferraris. It was the AF course cars that came through in the end. The yellow privateer, and I say that in inverted commas, Satellite 499P, the 83 of Robert Kubica, the EFIE, and Philip Hansen, that edged out its factory stable mates and overwhelmed all other challenges to take the win. Kubica and Yee becoming the first drivers from their respective Poland and China to claim overall victory with a hypercar record 387 completed. That I think it's the highest count in 10 years overall.
Only 10 away from the outright distance record of 397.
Yeah, we'll talk about it more in a minute. Remarkably clean race. We'll get into the ins and outs of that very, very shortly. Cadillac Hertz Team Jota got the front row lockout. Porsche Penske Motorsport charged the lead in the first hour, only for the first of the Ferraris to take the lead by hour three. And by sunset, it was a Ferrari 1-2-3 at the front. But late in the race, the number six Porsche Penske Motorsport 963 of Kevin Warrior Estra, Lawrence Vantor, and Matt Campbell drove past the two factory Ferraris and from 21st on the grid after a post-qualifying disqualification, finished second by only 14 seconds after 24 hours of racing. I mean, it's the fourth closest finish in Le Mans history. Three winners, Alessandro Pierguidi, James Collado, and Antonio Giovinazzi finished third in the 51 Ferrari, leading until about 5 hours to go, when Pierguidi spun out when coming into the pit lane for a full service.
If you hear the frustration in Dre's voice, it's because the 51 was his public pick. With his prediction weight championship on the line, he had predicted the winner the last 2 years, both factory Ferraris. Didn't happen.
Not this time.
I was this close. I was this close to my own three-peat. This close.
The best part of this is that no matter how much, no matter how happy Dre is as a Ferrari fan, you know that he's still hurting inside.
The belt is this back on the wall. The belt is, I was going to wear the belt on the podcast. I had it prepared and everything.
You get nothing. You lose. Good you day, nothing. Sir.
I don't, like, but King's all right. The rest of you two can go straight to hell. I can't stand.
Or France. Wait, I was already at France.
The number 50 team of Miguel Molina, Antonio Fuoco, and Nicholas Nielsen was originally fourth until it was disqualified for failing post-race tech inspection, giving fourth to the number 12 Jota Cadillac and fifth to the number 7 Toyota GT1 GR10.
Yes, you see, in fitting this car with the TSO20 livery, all of the TSO20's luck all came crashing down on this car all at once on lap one.
Yeah.
And then it was inflicted even worse on the number 8 car, which didn't have a throwback livery.
Indeed.
Yes, that just had the typical Toyota, what the fuck just happened, implosion of their race at the final few hours of Le Mans. Yeah.
I've been to 3 of these. This was the third most exciting Le Mans 24 hours I've went to. It was very professionally driven. There was only one safety car intervention the whole time, and not a lot of
worth noting as well. That safety car pretty much perfectly split this race in two, because it happened about a half hour before halfway, and we got going about maybe 5 minutes before halfway actually triggered.
It's like last year when we had the 6 hour rain intermission.
I love that. Yeah. 18 hours of Le Mans.
It's just like I went to bed last year and it was just like I woke up and it was like nothing had happened because it was all just rain delays. And amazingly, when I was watching this race on our Discord server, I watched the first pretty much 10 hours nonstop. It got to about 2 in the morning. Martin Haven came out with a rant about why aren't there more British women in the Iron Dames team. I took that as my cue to go to bed, and the race's only safety car was 10 minutes later.
Yeah, my review of the commentary this year is one that I have to steal. Martin haven't got a clue. He was talking complete nonsense for pretty much 90% of his time on air.
It was rough. It was an experience.
Thank God for Anthony Davidson.
I say that every time I watch an F1 race on Sky.
Thank God for David Addison and Graham Goodwin talking about what happens when a rabbit headbutts a BMW GT car. with apologies to Yasser Shahid and number 31 machine. But Dre, I'm going to talk.
Who had a worse weekend, that rabbit or the groundhog that Lewis Hamilton hit?
They're both dead.
I think it's a draw somehow. I think it's a tie. RJ, you're saying.
I want to talk about Robert Kubica. And I'm going to save some time to talk about the Philip Hansen and Yi Fei because they're important too. But I think for a lot of people, the big story is Robert Kubica winning the 24 Hours of Le Mans and the apex of the comeback that was already complete a while ago. If you're newer to motorsport, you don't remember, Robert Kubica broke on the F1 scene in 2006 with BMW Sauber. It's Poland's first ever F1 driver. And he had a little bit of something that just made you think this guy could be special. And you started to see some of that around 07, 08, where he's getting on the podium consistently with a team that looks like it is moving up in the world. Know what eventually happens, but at the time, it looks like it's moving up the world. It culminates in 2008 at the Canadian Grand Prix. A year ago, Robert Kubica had a horrible accident at Montreal. Going into the hairpin, he comes back and wins the race, his first Grand Prix win of his career at the same venue. And for a brief moment, it even gives him the lead in the world championship.
It did,
again,
yeah.
We know what happens with BMW Sauber in 08 and 09, but Robert Kubica's quality is still very much there. It's there when he moves to Renault in 2010. The car is not up to championship caliber by any means, but he's overdriving it. And heading into 2011, it looks like it's going to be another case of the same. More importantly, Robert Kubica's free agent, and I believe it is still said to this day that he had a pre-contract agreement to join Ferrari in 2012. But as we all know, that's not how things happen. February 2011, Kubica decides to warm up for testing by taking part in Rally and Andorra, and he has an awful crash. He's very lucky to be alive, but he suffers severe injuries to his right arm.
Life-altering.
And yes, life-altering injuries. His range of motion, his arm, is still not the same to this day, and it's been a dozen years. And at the time, as time passed, we realized it's very likely he's never going to drive a race car again. And eventually he does. In fact, he tries to reinvent himself in the sport that claimed his F1 career. And for a little bit, he's doing well. Robert Kubica is a World Rally 2 champion. He won that title in 2013, and it shot him up to the World Rally Championship 2014. You're thinking, right, Robert Kubica is about to take rallying by storm in the mid-2010s, and it's just not what happens. Kubica is quick, but he can never keep the car on the road. Then when the sponsorship runs out, that ends his rally career. So he looks towards endurance racing, and he gets an interesting offer heading into 2017. He gets an offer to drive for the Baikalis Racing Team and their Enso CLM P101. You know what he did in March of 2017, Trey, that changed his entire career trajectory?
What's that?
He bailed on Baikalis Racing Team.
Yeah,
best decision he's ever made.
RJ,
there's no way it's that bad. I mean, how many laps did that car last in the 2017? It was under 10.
A race they could have had a podium simply due to the lack of entries in that class, and they are not even factored.
What did he do? He had another LMP1 that blew the fuck up in 2017.
I say that to say this. Robert Kubica gets it in his head that he could make a Formula One comeback. And he spends 2017 and 2018 preparing, signs a test deal with Williams to try and get back to Formula One. And in 2019, 8 years after he has a life-altering rally crash and is likely told he'll never drive a race car again, he's back in Formula One. Was he the Robert Kubica of old? No, not by a long shot. That tenure lasted a year and a couple of COVID substitutions in 2021 with Sauber that we all forget about. But just by getting back to that point, Robert proved his point that he could make it back. So he still wants to continue racing. He goes to DTM in 2020. And then he goes to LMP2 racing in 2021. And Robert Kubica has a pretty outstanding LMP2 career. He's a three-time LMP2 champion, twice in the European Le Mans Series, once in WEC, the last LMP2 champion. And Le Mans was something that he could have won in his first appearance, but on the last lap of the race, driving alongside Guillefe and Louis Delatraz for WRT, final lap they're leading, and then the car breaks down. But he eventually finds his way up to the top class in this satellite Ferrari last year. The 83 crew wins at COTA. And then this year, Robert Kubica leading the charge for the 83 team, driving the last 3.5 hours of the race without his drink bottle for a lot of it and nursing a Gearbox problem in the final hour, comes through and wins the race. He had already completed the comeback. This is the pinnacle. There are not many people that have won a Formula One Grand Prix in the 24 hours of Le Mans in their careers. Robert Kubica is in a very special club. And how fitting is it that he does it for the manufacturer that should have been his launching pad to even greater F1 success before it was seemingly taken away, but found success in a different way. I am so, so happy to have seen that.
And it's richly deserved that this Le Mans has kind of been a little bit transcendent in terms of media coverage. I mean, look, we all love Le Mans here, but we're all hardcore friggin' podcasters. Like, this was front page on BBC Sport. This was one of the highest rated, like, page view stories on Autosport this year. There's a little bit of inside information for you. Yeah, it's... His story went viral. I mean, because I saw the clips from the Grand Tour where Jeremy Clarkson talks about Kubica just making it back into sports cars. And that was a story in of itself. Look, Robert Kubica is one of only two drivers this century to win an F1 race and win the 24 Hours of Le Mans. Fernando Alonso is the only other one since we hit the 2000s.
It's good company.
It's pretty good company, you know.
That could have been the 2012 Ferrari team.
Yeah.
Just to tie a bow on it.
Arguably, it should have been, you know. And look, if you're listening to this show, you don't need me to tell you that Robert Kubica was a superb talent in his prime in Formula One. He was seen as a star of the future. And he had earned the right to be in an elite seat in Formula One by that point. He'd impressed all the way up the ladder. A superb talent. And as much as many have said that he's one of motorsport's greatest what-if stories, he's not a what-if story. He's a great story, period. Because what's the what-if? He's just won the 24 Hours of Le Mans. Like, it doesn't get much better than that in the pantheon of motorsport. You know, it's a remarkable journey and career. And as Clarkson said in that video you've probably seen on social media, this is a man who had 18 operations to get back to this point. He broke almost every bone on the right-hand side of his body when he had that rallying crash. The fact he's alive is a miracle. The fact he's a Formula One point scorer and Le Mans winner after that fact is utterly remarkable. It is nothing short of a miracle that he's in this position. And like I said, I'm so glad that the world got to see that at large, because motorsport very rarely has positive stories on that level. The story that's so uplifting. Like, as Jason, one of our most devoted Discord servers, said, I probably wouldn't be a motorsport fan, and I probably wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Robert Kubica. That stuff moves people. We don't get that in this sport very often. And on a level, motorsport normally only goes beyond its remit when it comes to coverage when someone dies. And that's the horrible reality of journalism and what people are attracted to, one of the stories they want to read about. And it is what it is in that regard, but it's a wonderful, wonderful story. And man, it was a special moment. You'll be hard pushed to find a better motorsport moment this year than that. Like, if there wasn't a dry eye in the house, it's not just Robert's glory. And you know, we need to make that point very clear. Because I know a lot of people have zoned in on the Kubica time, which is understandable, given. You know, it would take 50.
We've been here 10 years ago, Cam, with a prominent Formula One driver getting a lot of the attention and two drivers behind him who did just as much, if not more, to make it possible. Yifei, I would say, has been one of the most criminally underrated drivers that's emerged on the scene in the last 5 years. There is an argument to be made that if you measure his single-seater career from about 2015 to about 2020 or so, up to Zhou Guan Yu's, and this is not to disparage Zhou Guan Yu's, but you can make the argument that Yifei had a stronger resume, but his single-seater career flatlined once we got to what we now call Formula 3, but pivoted to sports cars and has made an exceptional, exceptional career out of it. Became the first official Ferrari driver from China to represent the brand after he had got 2 years ago, in a space of 1 hour, Ye Yafei, with his raw speed, drove to the lead of the 24 Hours Le Mans and then crashed the Porsche. And I was sad for that.
Mm.
But he gets a fresh start with a new manufacturer. He wins at COTA, and then he wins the 24 Hours Le Mans. I am so glad that he is getting the recognition that he deserves. He straight up won the best drivers in this field, especially on a good day. And he had an exceptionally good day.
Those two, if you know the B pillar in sports car terms, those shout two top the shout out B pillar. We love you. Those two top the B pillar.
Yes, they set the two fastest average lap time of the race. They're 50% fastest lap for the best of everybody. And Philip Hansen, maybe not his best day, but it was enough to get him the win. And what a story he's got, because he starts in the Brick Car Endurance Championship in like the very grassroots of UK sports car racing. He enters the FIA driver categorization as a bronze. He enters it at the same level as your software developers and dentists and doctors alike. He climbs up the LMP2 ladder the hard way, breaks in with privateer GTP team JDC Miller Motorsport last year, then takes over the seat that's vacated by Robert Schwartzman, and he wins the 24 Hours of Le Mans. I know that there are some people in the media who are very Marmite at Philip Hansen, because when he has a bad day, he'll let you know when he's having a bad day. There's no question about it. But he is a very talented driver and a richly deserved winner of this race.
Indeed, indeed. I mean, King, I'll go to you for a minute as well, man. How did you feel watching that Ferrari come through and seeing the 83 come through? Because you watched about as much of this race as anybody else did on our Discord server. You're a staple in there as this race was playing out.
Yeah, of the Ferraris that stood a chance to win, it didn't feel like the 83 was the favorite. It just felt like they made the fewest mistakes down the stretch, that when things mattered, they were faultless where it needed to be. They didn't have a perfect race, but they had a better race than the quote-unquote factory Ferraris.
Well, the factory Ferraris, unfortunately, absorbed some of the haunts from the F1 team via osmosis, because they had this race in their hands. I mean, Ferrari ran a lot of this race, 1-2-3, but Dre, your 51 had this race in the palm of their hands and left it in a gravel trap.
They had it. They had I want to say 15-second lead in the lead of the race when Pierre Guidi comes in with 3.5 hours to go and spins out on the pit lane. Was lucky not to get a penalty for crossing the pit entry line as well. There was a lot of confusion about that in the rule book as well. But either way, that Ferrari lost a good half minute via that pit lane spin out. And well, after that, they were never really looking like they were back in it, even with the extra virtual energy advantage they had down the stretch. It just wasn't enough of a disparity between the amount of time needed to recharge their tank and the gap that was growing in front of them. James Colodo just didn't have the pace on that final stint to really force the issue. And it's a weird one in the sense of Porsche got in there, they got their hands dirty, and you know, they were second, as we mentioned earlier, fourth closest Le Mans finish of all time. They were 14 seconds off the win. But it never really felt like Porsche were going to win this race. And then
we tried, man. We tried. Kevin Estra put in the first stint of the gods to go from last to fifth. He puts in Iron Man after Iron Man stint across this race. as do his two co-drivers, who actually ended up faster on the B pillar on account of the fact that Kevin Estre did 403 overtakes across this race.
Yeah, and I'd argue that Kevin Estre didn't even have the most impressive overtake. That would have been Lawrence Vanthor early in the race using one of the GT Ferraris as a pick to sail past his teammate Matthew Jaminet in the Porsche curves in a move that was either going to end brilliantly or in a spectacular accident.
Yeah, chalk that one up on the Scotty. Roger might have had a heart attack if those two hit each other. And man,
I wanted to see it.
We did our best.
I wanted to see it because what was
the aggravating thing is that Porsche had not the fastest car, but certainly the next one up down the field. And they were literally perfect in the pits.
Yeah.
They executed 93 pit stops across three cars, nary a mistake, and the shortest averages out there.
Yeah. Urs Kuradel, who runs the Porsche Hypercar program, manages all of Porsche's global motorsport, he said, "We spent three fewer minutes in the pits than our competition." Now, of course, some of that is also down to pit lane penalties for Ferrari, because every one of the three Ferraris had a penalty at some point, whether it was a drive-through for speeding in the yellow flag zone where the dames broke down, or in 51's case, a 20-second stop-go penalty for speeding the pits, or a couple of 5-second pit penalties for leaving the track and gaining advantage. So they weren't perfect.
On a quick tangent, there were so many pit lane violations in this race across the week. What was going on there? Were sensors just not working? Like, there was so many mistakes.
Not everyone in Hypercar got them, but it felt like it was all in the Hypercar class.
Right.
Both Alpines actually did set their pit limiters wrong, and both copped major penalties for it. Number 7 Toyota copped a major penalty for it. Coach K in the driver's seat was 20 kph too fast in the pit lane. Bro,
that's not even
been
close.
At this too long to be doing that, and that is that is like the prologue to the first chapter of how awful Toyota's Le Mans was this year. But
it is wild in that one. Like, it's as RJ sums up in our notes, it was an imperfect perfect Ferrari because you know, they were sloppy, they made mistakes, all of them did. There was opportunities for them to be beaten in this race. And Porsche executed, at least with the number 6 car, a near flawless race, and it still wasn't enough.
You have to wonder how things would have been different if the number 6 Porsche was simply at the minimum prescribed weight in the first round of qualifying. Because that's what happened. That car got thrown out of Hyperpole for being underweight. Another Team Penske technical scandal has hit Major Motorsport 2025. But we all forgot about it by the end because the number 6 Porsche crew drove it from 21st to 2nd and were 14 seconds off the win, which would have been Roger Penske's first, which would have been Porsche's 20th. And Lawrence Vanthor would have become the first driver ever to win all three legs of the Triple Crown of Endurance in the same calendar year.
I honestly, with all the talk about Nick Tandy and Felipe Nasr being in the calendar Triple Crown conversation, I forgot Lawrence Vanthor was also in that club.
He was their plus one.
He was their plus one. He was a designated driver in every sense. And it just wasn't quite there. And that must be immensely frustrating for Porsche. We're given. And again, look, we all know it's not gone their way in WEC this year and what have you. But it must be irritating knowing that you went in there, you executed just about as well as you could have possibly done. Dodged all the hurdles of bad luck, and you still lost. It's just ridiculous in that sense.
Yeah. And I think that probably leads us to, I guess, what is largely blame for the what takes the blame for this, for the reason why this race wasn't as exciting as the last two, was the balance of performance. It seemed like when you run the numbers, everybody looks competitive. But once it got to race time, Ferrari's race pace was just overwhelming. Now, this could have been a much bigger ass beating from Ferrari over the field than everybody else. But Toyota's David Flory and Peugeot's Olivier Janson both basically said without saying it that they didn't have their teeth. They had their claws ripped out. They had their teeth ripped out of their face. They had nothing to bring the fight to Porsche or Ferrari in this race.
It's one of these things with BOP, and we always talk about it. I mean, I joke about it every time I sit down in Autosport and produce their WEC podcast with my editor-in-chief, Kevin Turner, and Gary Watkins, who does a brilliant job as their sports car correspondent. Shout out to Gary. He's cool as shit. But the man, every time BOP is mentioned, it's like a light bulb switches on in his head, and he turns Super Saiyan. It's crazy. And it's for that very reason. You can't get away from a BOP conversation, because I know it. And look, I know it's an incredibly difficult thing to do, to try and get as much of these manufacturers in the window as you can possibly give them, and try to have 100% parity, which honestly might be virtually impossible given the unique nuances of these cars.
I mean, you're seeing it at IMSA. Like, Ferrari's on a 4-race sprint streak now. So is Porsche and IMSA. And that streak only just ended in Detroit in a race that Porsche could have won anyway.
And wasn't that after IMSA had to manually adjust the BOP to bring Porsche down a peg?
They made a manual adjustment, and IMSA president John Doonan, like, regardless of whether or not you agree with them making a manual adjustment because they messed it up earlier, I appreciate the openness about it, where he said, we have a right to ensure equal competition. And so we talked with our manufacturers and said, this is the direction we want to go down. And they all said, okay, sure, we'll go along with it. I think this is part of the frustration with WEC, is because from 2023, they instituted a new BOP system where they basically split the season up into first half BOP, Le Mans BOP, second half BOP. But they also have like this, there's no other way to call it anything other than a gag order, where they basically tell everybody don't talk about it.
Which I've never understood.
Yeah, I understand that you don't want balance of performance to be the overriding storyline of any given race weekend all the time ever. But it also, you've also taken that transparency out. And I guess that's a reason why people have a problem with what happened pre-Le Mans 2023. I fundamentally disagree with Cam Buckley that it turned the race into a tire shambles. And looking back in hindsight, if they didn't do something to pad back the LMHs, Toyota would have swept the season, and that would have looked really, really bad for Hypercar in the first year of this so-called golden platinum age. And regardless of how Toyota got hammered in that race, they were still a lockup into an arnage away from doing it anyway.
Yeah.
Imagine there will not be that same hesitation towards making a manual adjustment to Ferrari. I fully expect when the spreadsheets come out for Sao Paulo, Ferrari is going to be at about, they're going to be at the numbers Toyota was at up until this race.
I was going to make the point that, look, Toyota were not winning this race even if they had a more favorable BOP. It was the mistakes that they made as a team and crew that hurt them just as much, if not more, than the BOP adjustments that came into play beforehand. The execution of Toyota as a factory was as big a part of their downfall here as opposed to what the numbers and the spreadsheets say. But it's, I know the ACO does Le Mans differently. They go by the previous year's Le Mans. It's treated separately compared to the standard World Endurance, World Endurance Championship season.
All the other WEC rounds are on standard ass permanent road courses, which Le Mans most certainly ain't.
Exactly. So I know it's.
We've got again, if you have access to all that data, why wouldn't you use it to try to get a better picture of what the current state of performance is between all the cars in competition?
I don't know. Like, and that's the question that baffles me most as a new-ish sports car fan trying to get into the series, trying to understand the logic and the methods and the thinking of the ACO to get us to this point. Because I've had a taste of BOP via World Superbikes. They opened that Pandora's box back in 2015 when Jonathan Rea and Chaz Davies were the two dominant riders in Worlds on a Kawasaki and Ducati, respectively.
Yeah, and you remember the debate at the time. Jonathan Rea was still winning all the time, and the discussion was like, you got to take revs off the Kawasaki's, which he was riding at the time.
Yeah.
But the problem was that Rea was like the only Kawasaki rider that was consistently able to take the fight to the Ducati's at that given point in time. Sometimes it is just a rider and a driver and a team difference.
And we've seen it in Worlds multiple times. It wasn't just Jonathan Rea. You can make an argument. At one point, it was Chaz Davies. At one point, it was Alvaro Bautista, which was probably the reason why we ended up having a combined white rider and bike weight mandate put in. And we've had now with Toprak, who's now been such a freak for BMW that they've been hurt by losing their concessions, despite Toprak being the only competitive BMW.
And to that point, WEC did institute, which is what people have been asking for, and I'm glad that they introduced like a combined driver. They have up the ballast, so that way smaller drivers don't get an inherent advantage, and bigger frame drivers don't have to emaciate themselves just to drive a hypercar like we were doing with F1 drivers in the mid-2010s.
Exactly.
I'm glad they made that change. And I understand some of the thinking behind the new for 2025 balance performance process, but I think I have seen enough to say that, like, look, if the Ferrari gets the another 20 kilograms to Toyota treatment, runs on minimum power, maximum weight for the rest of the season, and is still performing at a high enough level that they can take podiums, we got to start talking about this car as perhaps the best of its era, right? And they've got a good enough team and good enough drivers to extract the results no matter what the situation was. And 2 years ago, this car was underbaked. It couldn't keep heat in the tires, and it was all just kind of second rate to Toyota. Well, now Ferrari surpassed that.
But they've now won three straight Le Mans, and they're now overwhelming favorites to win the World Endurance Championship driver's title now as a result of this year. They finally figured this out. The problem, I fear, is that the 6 hours of Spa was close. Alpine was right there with them at the end. Like, if you're, again, I don't know exactly what these guys are looking at data-wise. I fear, given how this WEC season has played out so far, given how Le Mans has played out, where Ferrari never really looked like losing that race for a good 16 out of the 24 hours, they're going to be reluctant to throw the hammer at them. And that's what concerns me. Like, well, people are going to be awaiting the Interlagos balance sheet with bated breath, because if Ferrari doesn't get the hammer thrown at it, there's going to be riots in the streets of Brazil.
And then, of course, you have the opposite problem, where if you throw the hammer at them, all of a sudden Ferrari is not going to be happy about it.
Yeah, because...
But that is also kind of the...
And then,
that's what you earn. Toyota can speak to this from experience.
And then you have to look at it from the marketing perspective, where it doesn't really matter what you did now. Like, for most people, the only race that matters, they just won.
Exactly. They've already got the glory. They've won Le Mans, and barring a miracle, they've probably got the World Endurance Championship with one hand and four fingers on it now. Because obviously Le Mans counts double. So, like, they're in a commanding position right now. Like, it's going to take a miracle for that gap to be overturned now.
So, what they'll do is they'll calculate it based on the previous two out of three previous WEC rounds, and I expect there to be a significant change bring the rest of the competition up towards Ferrari's level. Ferrari's going to get a nerf. I think that I'm not one of these people that sincerely believes that, oh, the ACO got Ferrari. That means they're going to go back. They're going to be in their back, each other's back pockets all the time because they waited 50 years for this to happen and now it's happened and they don't want to risk it. I don't think this is how that works. I think, if anything, like, I do think there needs to be a change. I have seen enough to where there needs to be a change, and I'm expecting it to happen. Saw it in IMSA. It happened. Porsche were still competitive. First race afterwards, and I expect them to still win the IMSA GTP title. It's like I expect Ferrari to win the World Endurance Hypercar Championship.
But your headline race was 50% plus dominated by one manufacturer locking out the podium till the closing stages, and they've gone 100% on the season so far in WEC.
They led 69% of the race. Pretty nice.
If that's not enough to facilitate a change, King, then I don't know what is, because like where do we go from here now? Because I get it, it's a juggling act to keep manufacturers happy. That's kind of the whole problem with BOP in the first place. You can't please everyone. Yeah. But where are we going to go from here now after this? Because this felt, despite there being a 14-second battle for the win to close out a Le Mans, yeah, which is about as good as motorsport is supposed to get, it never felt like the 83 wasn't going to win. King's just shaking his head, and that just says it all, really.
There's just no other way to put it. Like, it felt handily Ferrari's in a system literally designed to prevent stuff like this.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we saw it in 2023 with Toyota, and that's why the ACO stepped in. Even if you don't agree with the reasons why, they stepped in and made a business decision, and in the end, Toyota still could have swept that season.
What's best for business, though, in the eyes of the ACO?
Like, the example with Toyota just shows that they have gotten it wrong in the past and not learned.
Yeah, and they've gotten it wrong again for this, second time in 3 years now, are in this situation again where they almost seem, they've locked the gate after the horse has bolted, and we still haven't sure they've actually closed that gate yet. Because we're sitting here not knowing what's going to happen for Interlagos after Ferrari had Le Mans in a vice grip. Ferrari locked out the top
clutch.
Yeah, they locked out the top seven on the B pillar and had eight out of the top 10.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. It doesn't get much more dominant than that.
Yeah.
Ducati in MotoGP would weep for that kind of result sheet.
Absolutely, man. I don't want this to be used as a launching pad to take anything away from what the winning Ferrari crew accomplished in this race. But I think it is time that the ACO responded and give the rest of the field their teeth back.
I agree. 100% agree. But hey, if you're one of the people that doesn't like Ferrari, and I know there are many of you out there, you can take some small solace in the fact that the number 50 got yanked off the board altogether.
Yeah. This is a strange one. They didn't have all the rear support bolts in the rear rings, the bolts in the rear ring support. Some of those were missing, which first of all took the car out of its homologation, which is already strike one. And then number two, on top of that, so what's the maximum deflection angle of that rear wing? I believe it's like what, 15 millimeters?
I believe it was in Formula One, certainly. They knocked it down to 10 when we got to the Spanish Grand Prix this season.
Here we go. Article 3.8.7, LMH technical regulations, maximum permissible deflection at 15 millimeters.
There we go.
The rear wing deflection recording during the Porsche race test for the number 50 car was 52 millimeters.
Ooh.
That is more than three times the legal limit. They got thrown out of fourth. You're wondering why they inspect the top four. Well, in case one of the top three fails, move up. You can move up the top four. Just in case the top four fails, now you can move up the fifth place car.
Yeah, close enough. I mean, I think Ferrari said they just lost screws in their rear wing and it just made the whole thing loose, basically.
Yeah.
And they claim it didn't give them a performance advantage, and I'm just like, that's cute.
It is cute. It's not the real, it's not all the reason why this car and the other two sister cars led almost 70% of the race, but it's still outside of scrutiny. It's still outside the rules. It's still an easy disqualification.
There's a big reason why McLaren were totally okay with their little mini DRS trinket they had going on at Baku last year, okay? Non-performance enhancing my ass. Okay. Like, it's unfortunate, but them's the rules. And
yeah.
Yeah, it promoted the number 12 caddy into fourth place instead. That had a very, very quick car. Probably the big winners of the BOP, really. In the grand scheme of things in the end. But yeah, it's rough. And also, there's Raptor points in our chat. The stewards report says, quote, the competitor explained this decision was made after reviewing the car telemetry, which allegedly showed no change in the car's top speed. The stewards noted that car 50 achieved its highest top speed on lap 380 of 387. Whoops.
Whoops.
I mean, let's quickly go over the rest of the field, RJ, because it was certainly a mixed bag from the other manufacturers that weren't Ferrari or Porsche. Cadillac first, what did you make of them?
Excellent week for the gold Hertz team Jota cars. They blocked out the front row. They finished 4-7 after the qualification. They did start to tumble down the order from the first stint onwards, which was not encouraging, but they started to come back little by little and got a good result. You take those. On the other hand, the IMSA invitees from Action Express and Wayne Taylor just had a tough weekend. Wayne Taylor Racing were compromised by technical setbacks. They had little issues throughout the race, and then they had an oil punched in the engine. And then the 311, the Action Express car, was actually having a good race until it died about three quarters of the way in, which, man, that's just tough. What do we got to do to give the IMSA invitees a break?
I don't know, some technical help, something.
They got all the technical up. That's the whole thing about this. Cadillac is like entering this under a one Cadillac mantra, but they want their three teams to act as one big one car team with different colors and sponsors and all that stuff. And I'd say for the most part, it's just, man, the IMSA teams were just so freaking unlucky.
Yeah, it's. I mean, you talk about this being a big one car, one team conglomerate. Really, is it a good sign when there's been an ongoing joke that one of the cars has been cursed for years?
Not really. It's still hard to shake that curse sometimes, even when that team, Chip Ganassi Racing, is no longer involved in the sport.
Indeed, yeah, different owner. You know, same policy. Unfortunately, but you know, shout out to the Jota guys. They were very, very quick. Alex Lynn was the pole sitter after all. A genuinely great moment. So Jack Aitken broke the all-time hypercar lap record in the session before that. Great timing, Jack. Not quite where you needed it to be, but it counts. You know, we'll go with that. But and also a shout out to Jenson Button, who said this was his last Le Mans this year. Certainly a salute to one of to got it. As I call him, your dad's favorite F1 driver. Everybody likes Jenson Button. Everybody likes JB, apart from his predators. Anyway.
King, the Toyota Gazoo Racing had a really tough day at the office because we mentioned Toyota finished an agonizingly close second the last 2 years. They could have, in an alternate timeline, won seven in a row, King, with a chance to win eight in a row, which would have set the record this year, but they were just never in it. As David Florey said after the race, we were losing performance from the first turn into the first chicane, and then up to the second chicane, and then up to the third sector. Only the 50 Ferrari's disqualification salvaged a streak of top five finishes, and at best, the number eight was a fringe podium contender until the nut came off the left front wheel of the number eight car, while Ryo Hirakawa was helping his team fight for a podium. I mean,
yeah, it just was the case where, as you said, they were off the pace, but like just operational errors that you wouldn't expect from Toyota just kept cropping up.
I know the number seven crew reported that they had a first lap collision that slowed them down for big chunks of the race. They had the big pit lane speeding penalty. They were very lucky to get fifth out of this all the end. Even still, I think, how different could the battles for the podium places have been? I'm not saying the eight car would have won, although even though it was my pick to win, in hindsight, I don't think it would have won. But think of how different the podium places could have been if not for that wheel nut failure at the start of a lap.
That was a race killer. Like, sometimes you can nurse those back to a pit lane and you don't lose too much. That was at the straight out of the pits. That is as bad as it gets. And the next 15 minutes was just riddled with slow motion footage of Hirakawa limping that car back to the pits and just going, it's all going away. Oh, just absolutely brutal for Toyota. Like I said, I don't think they ever truly had the speed to win this race. But as King quite rightly pointed out, even without it, the operational errors crippled this team. You know, the wheel nuts, the pit lane violation. Someone may need to put an arm around Kamui and say, maybe it's time, mate. Because he's been a talisman for this team and the speed is there, but he's having what I like to call a Grosjean decline, where the mistakes just keep creeping in and they're not pretty ones.
I don't even think he's the most scrutinized driver in the seven crew. Nyck de Vries got raked over the coals for missing hypercar 1 second slower than Brendan Hartley in the first round of qualifying.
It's not great.
And you start to wonder, maybe Kamui's not the problem. Or Mike Conway or Nyck de Vries or Rio Arakawa. Maybe. As good as the GR010 hybrid is, maybe they got to start thinking about a clean sheet design if it's possible.
Well, you say that, but they were Constructors Champions a year ago.
Yeah, that's the strange thing, too. They were Constructors Champions a year ago with all the 20 extra kilograms that they've had dumped on them.
Like, and that's 20 kilos per mean. Their car weighs about 14 tons right now. It's not ideal.
Not ideal. BMW, Team WRT's race just fell to shit on both fronts. Late in the race, both the M hybrid V8s took long trips to the garage, which doesn't really reflect that. Those cars were generally good second year around. They were constantly up there in the fight for like top 10, top 5, but they don't really have the result to show for it in the end.
Dries Van Tor is still a monster.
Golly, that man is fast.
He's still the king of the B-pillar merchants, but Dries Van Tor is a weapon of mass destruction. That man could drive.
Yeah, he could drive. Sheldon Van der Linde could drive. And some of the guys who were having trouble finding their feet in the program last year, like Rafael and Marcello, they're starting to get it. 17th and 18th. Last of the finishing hypercars does not reflect their true quality this weekend. Can I just say as well, it is good that Alpine made it. We ragged them all last year, but they got both cars across the line. And not only that, both cars across the line in the top 10 in the class, King.
Just incredible. I mean, admittedly, I was pleasantly surprised by a lot of the cars that I doubted would even make the finish this year.
King, you weren't alone. Think back to us watching that race together again. How many Mechachrome jokes were made over the course of that race? And they got past the 6-hour mark. It got past darkness. They were still chugging along when the sun came up again. They actually got they got cars in the top 10. And
yeah,
I know a lot of this is a little bit condescending because it's just so easy to rag on Mechachrome as an engine manufacturer for obvious reasons. But I'm just glad they got there. It's a step in the right direction, given with an Alpine, for a while, were the joke fodder of hypercar class.
You know what this tells me? It tells me that under these current regulations, if you have a part that you see is giving you trouble, You don't have to leave it the way it is. Alpine spent some time upgrading that Formula 2 engine that has inadvertently fed so many drivers out of the F1 pipeline into sports cars. And it's now reliable enough to run all 24 hours. The car wasn't as quick last year, unless it was the hands of one M. Schumacher. But they have a capable package.
And it's worth pointing out, if you look at the B pillar chart, Mick Schumacher was 15th fastest on rolling average overall and 9/10 a lap faster than anyone else in an Alpine. Holy shit, Mick Schumacher put in a shift. I'm so proud of him.
I'm so proud of him. He's going to price himself out of our sport, man. What a fucking shame. Speaking of going the distance, how about the Aston Martin of Valkyries? This was a vaporware project 5 years ago. This was vaporware. That car died on the concept table due to COVID in 2020 and Lawrence Stroll's desire to get an F1 team for his own. And then it's revived. We forget all about how, screw Aston Martin for bailing on the hypercar project so they could go run this mediocre F1 team. We love them. And now they finish with both cars. And one of them gets manufacturer's championship points.
I'm going to be completely honest. Mm. I didn't think either Aston would see sunrise. Like,
understandable.
They weren't fast, but they lasted the distance. And I think that's more than what people would have given them credit for after how bad a first race they had in Qatar. But every time they got, they just got a little bit better, and they haven't had any huge problems since.
But I think, like, we're underselling, like, finishing your debut Le Mans with both cars only 4 laps back of the leader is absurdly impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's...
Props to them. It goes to show you they're a well-run team, because that car didn't have any major issues across the 24 hours. It was reliable, maybe not the quickest, okay, far from the quickest, but part one of the battle is always make sure you can get your car home. And this is, and these cars are very temperamental, and Aston had to do a lot of changes to their Valkyrie to make this car eligible to run in this series in the first place. And they had their first Le Mans, and from an execution standpoint, they couldn't really have asked for much more. It's an excellent job, and a salute to everybody at the factory, because they've had to work round the clock to get Aston Martin even into this position. And, well, the fact they got both their cars home, and as the King says, only 4 laps off the winning car, that's really solid. That's
consider how far they were off the pace of everybody else for the first 3 rounds. That's a huge accomplishment. Shout out to successful sports car racing team owner Gabe Newell for helping make all of this possible.
Now, 4 laps back of the leader. Half-Life 4 confirmed.
Half-Life? We haven't even had 3!
Exactly. Back to back.
King, we got GTA 6 after Aston Martin finished at Le Mans.
No.
We
got the Aston Martin Valkyrie announced, canceled, revived, and both cars across the line before we got Elder Scrolls 6.
How? Jesus Christ.
And as for Peugeot, just throw it in the bin. The 94 had fun making extra long economy runs early in the race, and then they disappeared from the top of running order. This was not bad. This was a bad race. I'm encouraged that Stellantis wants to stay involved in endurance racing, but they got to figure something else out, because I sadly don't think the 9X8 Evo is working out, no matter what BOP you put on it.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't know why, off the evidence of last year's race, did you think, let's nerf Peugeot going into this year's Le Mans? I don't know what crack was being smoked at the ACO.
Oh, you know, typical ACO. Always accused of being anti-French.
I don't know what possessed them to make the decision that Peugeot needed to be brought down a peg after last year's running. But that's... It says it all when drivers like John Erik Verne, and to be fair, Jeff has never really pulled his punches when it comes to the media, bless him.
Oh, no.
He's always good for a soundbite. And Loic Duval, again, very outspoken Frenchman, were basically saying from Monday in practice, we have no chance. I believe the off-the-record term I was once told by Jeff during this race this week was, the BOP has fucked us. And no need to put a French accent on that one, quite frankly.
Hey, did you know that there was another Polish winner in this race? This is the craziest thing, because LMP2 probably salvaged all the excitement late in the race, because by about 4 hours ago, it was looking like an absolute titillating fight. In one corner, Inter-Europol competition, the team that surprised everybody by winning in 2023 as the clear underdogs of the LMP2 class. And in the other corner, VDS Racing with the backing of Monaco Grand Prix winner Olivier Panis. And King, it is an all-out brawl. But in the last hour, Nick Yellowly, who has been so good in the number 43 Inter-Europol car, he's been so fast, but his speed has cost him the race because he locks up the rears going into the pits. It's a pit lane speeding penalty. It's a drive-through. Inter-Europol has lost it, King. It's so tough. But hang on a second. That VDS Panis car is pretty slow coming out of the pits. A left front suspension failure within a lap of coming out. And Nick Yoli drives by Esteban Masson as if Masson, Toyota junior driver, by the way, Esteban Masson, is driving in first gear.
We didn't
Inter-Europol throws the race away and gets to reach in and pull it out of the garbage.
Dang, it's that meme. It's so over. It's so back. It's so over. It's so over. We didn't see the pass for the class win until there was 17 minutes left on the clock. That's how wild this was. And oh, man. Oh, it's you could see, like, the disgust that Olivier Panis has to take his glasses off when he sees his car beaten in the pit lane. Panis, who, by the way, has become one of the coolest people in motorsport, inked up, tattooed, and jacked in his maroon Mark VDS shirt. We like Van der Straaten. He's a cool cat as well in his own right. Oh, the pain. The pain.
Yeah. Oh. What a late. And you know what's crazy? That wasn't even Nick Yellowly's first pit lane fumble of the race, because he overshot his pit box, cost him a minute, cost him the lead in the race. Only a safety car for the Nielsen Racing car having a big crash. Cembalk Bassey's fine, thank goodness. Brought them back into it. They got bailed out twice. And now, having the dominant pace for all the race besides that, this time when Inter-Europol competition won, this wasn't a fluke. You didn't have to tear down the car for 2 months to try and see if they were cheating or not. They're just that good now.
Yeah, it's wild. Raptor puts in our chat. 18, 19, 20, 23, all DNFs. 2025, winner! it's absolutely wild. Absolutely crazy finish. And you know, it's a shame we didn't get more LMP2 coverage on TV, because that they were beating the piss out of each other all race long. I think for the majority of this race, the gap at the front wasn't more than maybe 10 to 15 seconds. Ridiculous.
Those two teams in particular were awesome. And shout out to AO Racing and TF Sports joint entry. Spike the LMP2 Dragon is a Le Mans LMP2 Pro Am class winner. PJ Hyatt wins on Father's Day. And when you consider that the whole reason why his cars have T-Rexes and dinosaurs on his cars is because of his kids, that's so cool. And I mentioned it earlier, Louis Delatraz finally got to win Le Mans 4 years after he lost it. He now has one half of his father's Le Mans win total.
Yeah.
What is the Delatraz family doing at Le Mans? Both generations are winning it. Happy Father's Day.
They were cooking. You love to see it. Let's put a neat little bow in it, RJ. Talk to me about LMGT3. Because once again, it's another case of death, taxes, Manti Porsche.
Porsche's 112th total class win at Le Mans. 112th major class win. Yeah, they've been at this game for a long time, it has to be said. And even when they weren't running the top class, they were beating the brakes off the lower categories. But I say that to say, Manti First Form Racing, Ryan Hartwick, Ricardo Pera, and Richard Leitz were in a class of their own, only matched by one, Dre. And I know it's going to pain you for me to tell you that Valentino Rossi really should have had a fighting chance to win this 24 Hours Le Mans, but 46 car suffers a power steering failure going in the Porsche curves, and that's pretty much all she wrote for Rossi, Amata Harthy, and Kelvin von der Linde. I know you're gutted.
Look, you would think in a time like this, I would rinse the Valentino Rossi camp for all it's worth. I will not. I will be sincere on this occasion and say, commiserations to the 46 crew. That's a shitty way to go out. Yeah. They were genuinely, in my opinion, the fastest NMGT3 out there. They have a great team, and it sucks the way they went out like that, because they had a genuine shot to win this. And look, even as a self-appointed Marc Marquez guy, I'll be the first person to admit it would have been great for business if Valentino Rossi had won in LMGT3.
Oh, absolutely.
Let's be frank, okay? People were lining up around the corner at the autograph booth for a piece of the doctor, okay? The man is a cult. The man is the needle mover. When it comes to motorsport,
maybe he's not the needle mover. He is the needle in the LMGT3.
He's the needle,
class.
The steering wheel, the engine, the doors, and most of the car. Robert Kubica might be the headlights. When it comes to relative clout here, like, look, it's a shame. And look, we can't. I can't even take the piss. Valentino Rossi is a genuinely good sports car driver. There's no getting around it. He's just good at this now. He knows what, and he's always been a ridiculous talent. And, you know, he's good enough where he's not dragging his team down, and that is more than enough in the category of GT sports car racing, and that's worth something. It's a fair
play.
He
has a role as a super silver, and he's excelling at it.
Yeah.
Manti winning this race also means an incredible milestone for the ace driver of the car, Richard Leitz, who was the most experienced driver in the field. That was his 19th start. That was his sixth class win at the Le Mans 24 Hour. And I want to bring something up, that here are the people that have won a major class of Le Mans six or more times. It's Richard Leitz. It's Olivier Beretta, who dominated a lot of the GT classes. It's six-time overall winner Jackie Ickx. And it's nine-time overall winner Tom Christensen. End of list.
It's a good list.
Six, and I don't know, Richard Leitz probably wasn't even the most impressive driver in that car. Ryan Hartwick was putting up silver level praise for bronze. Ricardo Pera should be a Porsche factory driver tomorrow.
I looked on B-Pillar. Ryan Hartwick was literally top bronze. Literally. By 2 cents of a second.
This makes him... I believe this makes him the first world jet ski champion to win the 24 Hours of Le Mans. It's a true story. And I don't know of any other drivers who were born in the state of Tennessee that won the 24 Hours of Le Mans class.
That's quite the... How do you go from being the best jet ski rider in the world to thinking, I'm going to give sports cars a go and then win Le Mans?
I don't know, man.
King, there's
I don't
still
know.
Hope for you.
No.
There's still time, King. You can still be a two-sport athlete.
Yeah. For a lot of reasons, again, I said, not the most entertaining Le Mans I've ever been to in person, but I am always happy to do this. I want to thank as well my boss, Ray Goodwin. You've probably heard on the television, putting up with Martin Haven, and thank my sub-editor Stephen Kilby, who's bailing me out of a lot of spots. Thank you to everybody at the Team Tennessee, and thank you to some of our photographers who've been shooting this race for 20, 25 years, and in particular, Regis Lefebvre, David Downs and Andrew Hall, who have all banded together and say, this is the last time we're shooting this race after 20 years. After 15 annual farewell tours, this was their 16th actual farewell tour. I'd love to see him come back one more time, but I can also, because it's a grueling race. It takes a lot out of you.
Absolutely.
To keep doing this and travel all this way to be a part of it. So I understand, especially when you get old like those guys. They don't want to keep this forever. So I'm glad they got to go out and shoot one more Le Mans. It's always great working with them. And it's always great coming to talk about Le Mans with y'all. Once it's all said and done.
Always a pleasure. And I've had to kind of grow into this role over the years because I was not a sports car guy when we first started doing this. And it's kind of just grown on me as the years have gone by. And look, it's become arguably the highlights of our Discord server every year when we got as many as 25 people in there watching this race together and just watching the carnage unfold. And this was not a classic Le Mans by any stretch. It's still ludicrously dramatic and incredibly entertaining, and so many stories to be told up and down the grid. The action is incredible. The thrill, the drama, the visuals, the community spirit of it all. It's a magical race. For me, it's the greatest race in the world, and even a not-so-good one is still a great one, if you catch my drift on that one. I mean, King, put a neat little bow in it. What did you make of this year's Le Mans overall, and what a time we had?
I mean, it's great to sit down and watch because, like, visually, Le Mans is such a unique circuit with, you know, it mainly being, like, public roads, and you get to see, like, you know, the transition from day to night, especially with the road markings that you would just see driving down the road on an average day. But the race itself was just as dramatic. I'm pretty sure a lot of racing fans out there have developed an opinion about Lexus over the past week. it was, no matter what the result is and how we got there, it was a fun journey.
It always is. It always is. We'll be back next year for the 94th 24 Hours of Le Mans. Thank you very much for listening to this extended edition of Motorsport 101. Next on our list, IndyCar, Gateway, beef. It's what's for dinner, and not in the NASCAR sense this time around. Enjoy that one later on in the week. Until then, I've been Dre Harrison, they've been RJ O'Connell, Cameron Buckley, and Ryan Eric King. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next time. Sayonara.
La 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 la